Top Spotting Preview, San Diego Comic-Con 2010.
Audio from the Composing for Sci-Fi Television and Movies panel.
So I'm here today. They asked me to step in and introduce this panel because obviously music has been tremendously important in True Blood, and I know that music is important in everything we watch. Welcome to Behind the Music with CW3PR, scoring for sci-fi, horror, and fantasy film and TV. I'm Charlene Harris. I wrote the Sophie Stackhouse novel. Being an author of what turned out to be such a successful series has been a very exciting experience. Seeing my characters come to life with the show's amazing cast has been incredible to witness. But one of the most remarkable moments for me was hearing the music of one of our composers here today, Nathan Barr. Show. It cascades through the scenes, and it has really helped drive the story in every possible way. And I know we all waited until the end of the show to see what song he selected to close the show with.
Oh, yeah.
While I may be one of the first people to touch a project, it's composers like these here today that end up sealing the deal for the audience. I, like many others, always remember a great score, whether it's for television, film, or any other medium. And I'll tell you now what music I listen to as I work. I listen to movie scores. The marriage of music and film or TV is essential. I couldn't be more pleased to introduce you to our stunning panel of composers, some of the most talented in the business today. Here to kick off the panel is a video of this group's pivotal work, a scene to picture, followed by an intro by the moderator and the BMI director, Anne Cesari. Enjoy, and thank you for having me here.
Ottman has been scoring films since 1993, beginning with director Bryan Singer's film Public Access, and then The Usual Suspects, both of which he was also the film editor. Ottman and Singer first began their co-directorial debut, Lion's Den, in 1988. Ottman continued to collaborate with Singer as both a composer and editor on films such as At the Pupil, X-Men 2, Superman Returns, and the historic thriller Valkyrie. Bubble Boy, Pumpkin, Trap, Cellular, Gothica, House of Wax, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Hide and Seek, Fantastic Four, Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, Astro Boy, The Losers, and the upcoming The Resident. Give it up for John. Top-rated shows on television since 1995's box office hit Dangerous Minds. They have composed for Bionic Woman, the opening titles to Carnival, Nurse Jackie, and Heroes. Next we have Jim Dooley. Jim. composer Hans Zimmer in 1999. He has since gone on to compose all episodes of ABC's Pushing Daisies, winning him the Emmy in 2008. He scored successful video games Infamous, winning him a Game Award in 2010. Currently, he is songwriting on the highly anticipated animated feature film Dorothy of Oz, starring Lea Michele as Dorothy. In 1996, he moved to Los Angeles to pursue a career in composing for film. Since then, he has scored over 30 feature films, collaborating with Eli Roth on 5 projects, including Hostel, Hostel 2, and the recent released Last Exorcism. Currently, Nathan scores for the HBO hit series True Love. From Berklee College of Music in Boston, later earning a master's degree in composition from the California Institute of the Arts. He is half the composing duo called the Track Team with his partner Ben Wynn. Together, they scored all 3 seasons of the Nickelodeon hit TV show Avatar: The Last Airbender. Spectre and the upcoming Jonah Hex, and currently are scoring the new animated Kung Fu Panda series debuting this fall on Nickelodeon. And last but not least, Michael Giacchino. Golden Globe winning composer for his work on Pixar's Up. His work has spanned all genres of entertainment, film, animation, video games, and TV. In 2005, he won his first Emmy for his incredible work on ABC's Lost. On Ratatouille and 2 more Grammys for Up. Michael is currently working on the upcoming feature films John Carter of Mars, Let Me In, and Super 8. Please give it up. So I'd first like to start off talking about how and when you discovered your passion for writing and composing music, and how that led you to your big break. Wendy and Lisa, please first. You have known each other a long time and collaborated, and then you get a phone call to work with an 80s rock band called Prince and the Revolution, and lead to Purple Rain. But what I want to know is how you went from touring and gigging and writing songs to scoring your first feature film of Dangerous Minds.
Yeah. Do you want to do the first one?
Okay. the band we were doing lots of gigs around, and of course we were writing songs, and we made our first album, and there was a song on that album called This Is the Life that, to make a long story short, they wanted to use it in the film Dangerous Minds, and Michelle Pfeiffer had heard it, she really liked the song, but they weren't happy with the score that was written at the time, which was being done by Mark Isham, who was brilliant composer, which just goes to show you how difficult this business can be sometimes, because he was a well-established, brilliant composer, and they just didn't like the score. So they kind of came to us because the film itself is like a sort of urban, you know, tough, whatever, colorful film, so to speak. us coming from a colorful background.
Didn't Don Simpson think we were black?
he said something about our balls or something. We had 18-year-olds and over. Young people go, hi, baby. So, yeah, our background with folk music and urban feel, but also our sensibility, the song that they used, that they chose, This Is the Life, is a ballad, piano, kind of piano string sound, kind of song, acoustic. So they thought that we would be the perfect team, and since we were already associated with the film, to take a shot at the score, and we assured them that we would tough it up for them. So,
was it a natural progression? Because I know sometimes for songwriters, it's not easy to score.
Yeah, we've always wanted to compose for film and TV. I mean, I grew up in the business, and so did Lisa, and our fathers were studio musicians, and my father was a big arranger, and Lisa's father was an experimental, along with being a percussionist, electronic musician.
Classically trained, and it was something we always wanted to
do. Yeah, I mean, we used to, when we were kids, we used to read scores and listen to the pieces from films, and we always wanted to do that. So there was this goal for Prince, because we were trained to be something other than just rock musicians, so it was a very natural progression for us. And I think that was one of the things that helped us transition into rock being a pop band, and the kind of colors that we added to that situation. We were sort of more pastoral in our approach, and more interested in trying to create a narrative to his music than just, strumming guitars and trying. So it was very natural for us to be handed the project, and it wasn't overwhelming for us because we've been in the studios as kids. So
right.
It was a great and lucky time for us.
Excellent. Nate and Jim, you both studied music composition in school, and so we have in common. You both actually started out working under Hans Zimmer. What was that like? do you feel that?
I was there very briefly.
I know. Yeah. That's
8 months.
8 months. Awesome. But I want to hear, too, about how you guys got to, and I know that you started out with Hans Zimmer, but Jim, how did you get to your first big break? Because I know that you don't come from a musical family.
No, that's right. I guess the odd part is I'm the first male in three generations to not be a New York City fireman. having a son that is really into classical music, when your father comes home smelling of soot, it was an anomaly in the Dooley household, to say the least. I have to say, I was going out to play baseball instead of really being studying Wagner at the library. But yes, I did work for Hans for 2 years as a tech from Gladiator, which is difficult to walk into from a technical position, and then later arranging, writing, and I've been. Still, actually, what was the artist formerly known as Media Ventures, and now known as Remote Control. It'll be 11 years. 8 months and 11 years.
See the difference? That's why we talk about this stuff.
It was really nice to have a mentor. It's like, it was one thing to know that you wanted to do it, and then to have to actually see what it took to do it that way, and then still want to do it after all the 100-hour weeks. I did Mission Impossible 2 with a hernia, and I wasn't allowed to have surgery until the movie ended. So that is true.
And those are the stories, the real stories.
My first kind of degree came with, was I guess, with When a Stranger Calls. I did for Screen Gems. And this was great. They were like, you just wasted on the album. Well, not in this case. The studio wanted, they knew it was a difficult score because the movie wasn't. But they didn't think that somebody with a lot more experience would go through the paces and take the notes and to take it on the chin. So this was probably one of the few gigs I got based on my demo pile recently after signing with an agent. That's when I discovered Klonopin. One before the meeting, one after. To do that, which was great, it turned in eventually, then, you know, we're doing obsessed and so on the screen gems because it's like, wow, how can these stay so calm when people are yelling at them? Yes, and in between, yes, doing the TV things. Essentially, the Stranger Calls was my first big feature film.
Got it. Nate, you were doing feature films, and then you got to work on your first TV series, which happened to be True Blood.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, sure. I sort of started, as she mentioned, I did about 30 features, 26 or 27, none of what you've ever heard of. but they were really great practice for me. And I did a film by Eli Roth called Hostel, which is a big orchestral score, and Alan Wall, the creator of True Blood, put my music from that into the pilot episode, and so I put that into the pilot episode, and I told him I didn't feel like it was exactly the right fit. It felt like a little bit too big for the show, and they really loved that I sort of shot my own music down. I sort of pitched them my idea, which is that I would perform the score in addition to writing it and keep it sort of very small and intimate and organic. And as a cellist and a guitarist, I felt like those two instruments would lend themselves really well to the storylines in True Blood. And so I wrote that Sookie, Bill and Sookie theme first, and Alan came over to my studio and took a listen to it, and thank God it was the right direction, and that was the beginning of that show.
John. Hi. You have a great story. I've worked with you on many panels, and I love hearing it. But
you're so great now.
Yeah, it's awesome. You've been making movies since you were small, in your parents' garage, and you actually went to film school,
right,
for film production. And as Michael did as well. But we'll get to you. When did you get the bug to score films, and who gave you your first shot?
I didn't really get a bug to score them. I was a fan of film music, and my goal was, of course, to be a film director and hire Jerry Goldsmith, who's my idol. you know, the way life is, you never do what you expect to be doing. So the bottom line is in the 80s, when MIDI technology came around, I just started experimenting and bought some old equipment and got the manuals out, learned how to sync a videotape with strike with SMPTE code and, you know, interlock it with a sequencer. And I would take my friend's student films from USC and rescore them. I would empty out all the sound and just do it as an experiment. So I started doing this as a hobby after I graduated from SC. And at the same time, of course, I was making movies and doing some stuff with Brian Singer. He was doing his first feature film, and I was the editor after a very long story that ended up happening. The composer dropped out in the last 11th hour. We had a Sundance deadline to get the movie at the Sundance Film Festival. So I said, you know, I can write the score, you know. I know this character. I'm creating him in the editing room. He goes, you just do all that flowery music, because I was doing a lot of industrials. I was doing Quickset Lock Company, but it was great. I paid like $100 to do employee training videos, and I did one for Amco Parking, and they're all just feel good, you know, like Brian called it gay flowery music. I said, no, I can really do a sinister score, you know. And of course, the joke of it is, after that film won the festival and they ended up in Usual Suspects, I was pigeonholed as the sinister dark guy. But basically, we did that film, and you know, no one just really at that time edited and scored a feature. So Usual Suspects, and this black note continues till today. You're not going to score the movie unless you edit it. So,
right. So you have double duty on all of this.
Yeah.
Films.
Well, I go away to editing jail for a year and a half,
right.
And I can't score any films. But that's what happened.
Corporate side by day and composing music by night,
yeah,
and weekends. During that time, you got the chance to score some video games. And I know that we'd love to know how that came about, and can you tell us how that led to you scoring for TV and meeting JJ Abrams?
Well, I was working in, as a kid, I grew up, I made movies all my life, stop motion mainly, and I just loved filmmaking. So when I got my first job in the studio was in publicity, which then led to a job as an assistant producer in video games, because once I was in publicity, I was learning that, man, all the producers are the guys that are hiring the composers. If I can become a producer, I can hire myself.
Very smart.
So the job opened up for me in the interactive department at Disney. I went there, got the job as an assistant producer, and kind of started messing around, writing music for the games I was working on. And then I went over to DreamWorks and Interactive, and I was an assistant producer there as well. But they had a meeting with Steven Spielberg this one morning because they were doing the game The Lost World, and they had it the next day. The meeting was the next day. So they came over to me and they said, we need some music for this thing. We're going to show them some animation and kind of show them some of the character designs. And we just want to lay some music down. You could just write us something just to throw in there. I was like, okay. So I wrote a piece of music and they threw it in there. And the meeting went on. I was up in my office, kind of oblivious to what was happening downstairs. And then the phone rings and it's the producer of the game, Patrick Gilmore. And he's like, hey, can you come downstairs? Steven wants to see you. And I'm like, in the middle of just like working on this terrible game that I was in charge of. I'm like, Steven, who? And he's like, Steven Spielberg. And I was like, what? So the building we were at was this escalator. So I go to the top of the escalator. And as I get to the top, I notice that Steven is standing at the bottom of the escalator. So literally, this was like the longest moment of my life. Thinking like, do I run down the stairs? Do I walk down the stairs?
Do you give him a hug?
And I decided just to stand on the stair and let the escalator take me to him. It was like a shot out of one of his movies. It was like the stairs of him. It was Steven Spielberg's face. His hand comes up. Michael, nice to meet you, and this and that. He's like, I love the music that you did. You're scoring the game, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. And he's like, and we're going to record it with a live orchestra, right? I'm like, yeah, we are. Right? And the CEO and the CFO were on either side of it. And at that point, they didn't want to do it live because they didn't want to spend money. We looked at both of them. We are, right? And they were like, yeah. Anyway, that game led me to Medal of Honor, which Steven also produced at the same time that he was working on Saving Private Ryan. And J.J. Abrams and his friend Jesse Alexander, who I think you guys may know because he worked on Heroes for a while, they played all those video games that I scored. And literally, I got an email out of the blue one day which I thought was a joke from one of my friends that said, hi, my name is J.J. Abrams. I wrote Armageddon, I directed Guardian Henry, and I'm working on a new show called Alias for ABC. Would you be interested in coming to talk to me about this? And I was like, who wrote this? Who the hell is J.J. Abrams? So I wrote him back, and I went and met with him, and that was, I found out he and I were like brothers instantly. We both loved all the same things, loved film scores, loved making movies. That's just what it's about, just making stuff.
Awesome. That's an awesome story. Thank you. So you all write for character-driven shows. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about themes for characters, because that just seems to me to be really exciting. You're writing for superhuman powers. They can leap tall buildings in a single bound. They fight giant robots. Gone where no man has gone before. But are there any challenges in writing for these superhuman characters, or sometimes unhuman, immortal characters? Do you find challenges in writing for them? And,
Michael? I was just going to say, depending on the project, Heroes, for instance, we collectively met with the producer, the writer, creator of the show, and we all talked about wanting to do something slightly more out of the box in the science fiction genre on television. slightly more more of a movie experience than a TV bumper stinger mentality, which is a is what they say when you're going to a commercial. So we wanted to make sure that we did something that was counterintuitive to what is normally done in the science fiction genre for television, which is, you know, big, heroic, flying music with strings and horns and snares and just the typical stuff that you might not really pay much attention to, but it's a familiar sound to a viewer. So the two of us wanted to go more into the subtext of these characters and create more of an internal process of confusion on why they have these superpowers instead of the feeling of being reconciled with it. I am this person. They're troubled that they've got this stuff going on. And that's sort of what we wanted to reflect in all of these characters. And we had to do it by taking each character and trying to create some kind of sound that we thought represented what their character's struggles were. So we talked a lot about how we were going to create these sounds. So the two of us, instead of relying heavily on, you know, buying samples out of the box, we'd sit in our room and we'd create sounds and we'd sample them and we'd have these sessions where we'd have, you know, we had our singer Shankar come in and he sang this amazing melodic vocals over chord progressions that we came up in like four different keys and had him just sing over it. It made it, again, it was more sort of this pastoral experience. And that became the overall arch sound of the show. And then within that, we had to come up with individual themes for everybody. But
for every character,
you would always, at some point, hear that voice that could tie it all together so it would be identifiable. But that was our way out. So we could come up with all these different sounds for different characters, but it would always be tied with that one thing that the viewer would always go, oh yeah, that's the sound of the show.
Sure.
You know, so that was giving it its own voice.
It was kind of fun with that we didn't have the sound effects sound department until the last season of the show, so we would always do the sound effects
that
with
sort
of each character's power.
Right.
So that would also take us out of the realm of like just playing like big horns and drums and, you know, to signify a power, you know, a powerful thing. And you would make up sound, something having electricity power, or make up a sound that is, you know, sound of electricity or something.
Talking about sound design, also I had a question for Jeremy as well for Avatar, because you and your partner, Ben, do the sound design and the music, so you have double duty there. And a lot of the ethnic instrumentation sounds traditional and authentic. Did you have to do a lot of research for that? And, you know, how do you make a sound for waterbending and for earthbending? How do you make that sound?
All right, I guess there's a couple of questions in there. Ben really took the job. After the pilot, we both did music and sound design. It was a joint effort. But we quickly learned that there was no way in hell we were going to be able to collaborate like that, you know, for the whole series. Just time didn't allow it. So Ben took on the role of sound designer, and I took on the role of composer for the rest of the series. But as far as the ethnic instrumentation goes, I really did not study any of that before Avatar. Brian Kaminsko, the creator, came to me and said, we want to make this show, and it takes place in this Earth-like place, but it's not really Earth. But it has to feel old and ancient, and it's Asian-esque, but it's not really Asian. So don't worry too much about being extremely traditional, but I sort of somehow fell into taking lessons on the Chinese pipa and the Gujin. I just couldn't say no. I'm like, I guess I'm kind of like an education junkie.
Right.
My dad was, you know, a lawyer, very intellectual. So I started studying Gujin and Pipa, and Gujin is a much easier instrument, and I sort of continued on a little more with that. And then as far as like the other, there's a bunch of ethnic instrumentation on that show. There's an Armenian dude.
Right.
And that I bought a VHS.
Really?
Basically, Brian and I came to us and they said, for next week, you have a Duke here and we don't have any money in the budget for Duke Claire. Let's go to a buy one and see what happens. Thank God for editing. But it turns out that it's a really, the instrument sort of like plays itself in a way, you sort of let go and things come out of it. So yeah, there's some degree of research and education certainly, and some degree of just winging it and hoping not to offend anyone. And then the sound design question: for a lot of the sounds we use our voices. Because again, when we started, we had no money. Seriously, newbies. And at CalArts, I got really into extended vocal techniques and all the cool stuff that makes you no money in the real world, but
somehow. But it worked out for you.
Yeah,
you're a two-game singer now?
Yeah, oh, sure. So we found an application for that, but a lot of times we would record these vocal gestures and impose them on sounds. So, you know, because the bending is so gestural,
right.
It sort of, you know, lend itself really well to that. For instance, a lot of the airbending sounds were voice manipulated.
Okay.
And even just like, you know, giant sort of balls of energy and things like that. And those sounds actually, even when we actually got to the point where we could afford a, you know, proper library, we continued to use those sounds because they just became part of the style. And in a way, they really helped sort of give us a unique voice. That limitation was actually really good for us.
For film, do you, when you're working on a film, do you guys get to sit in, you write the score, do you get to sit in with the sound effects guys and make sure that they're not blowing up stuff over your score and, you know, and allowed to kind of tell them where to set the levels and...
Well, there's always this best laid plan for mice and men where you get on the project and go, you really should talk to the sound effects guys and you all work it out together. And of course, you say yes to that. You're writing the score, they're doing their thing, and all gets worked out on the dub stage where it's a war between the effects and the music. And when you're the editor, of course, it's always a great mix. Having said that, though, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people agree here, you know, you often write music not to be so loud, and thank God, like with Opry, the music was intended to be embedded with the sound design that I, you know, like a lot of us are able to do for design and editing. And if I had been there, the music would have been too loud. It would have been sound goofy, you know. So it's meant to just be a pulse, you know.
Have you ever suggested silence?
Oh,
to
absolutely.
Many, 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 many times.
In fact,
do they take your advice?
There's a lot of films out right now that could benefit from that. So, stopping the music once in a while could be a stronger movie, but there's this fear, I guess, the moment the music stops, the audience is going to run out of the theater because they're so bored, I guess. But, it's really a statement about not being confident in your own movie. But I was going to say a whole thing about doing sound effects with your mouth. I don't know if you knew this, but you know, when Enterprise goes by the original series, the title sequence, I was the composer going, or whatever. If you listen to X-Men 2, when the jet is powering down, that's me going, I'm the computer one. You just pitch it up and you can.
Well, that leads me to another question. You actually just answered it. So, have you ever used some interesting materials? I thought I read, Michael, that you actually used pieces of the airplane crash for Lost?
Yeah, what we did, well, it was actually, I was talking to the producer, Brian Burke, and he was filming the pilot. And he's going, you should see this place, it looks amazing. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm on the beach and there's a crashed airplane. And it's everywhere. It looks fantastic. I was like, it sounds gruesome. Exactly. I said, what is it, just strewn everywhere? He's like, yeah. I said, you know what, go around and start banging on something. See if any of it is resonant enough that we could use it in the score. He goes, all right. And so he goes around and starts banging on things. And sure enough, he packed up in a huge crate, a bunch of pieces of the airplane. They shipped it back to me. And then we used it all the first season when the plane was a prevalent character in the series. And we hooked up all the pieces to Rax and the percussionist would just play them, and it's just a really kind of fun thing to do. Those unique sounds like you were talking about, you guys, and you just make your own stuff. It's great.
I have a very funny story. When Lisa and I composed the main title sequence to Nurse Jackie,
which, by the way, is nominated right now for the Emmy, so I just want to congratulate you. Two out of nine women in the history of this of that category. So, thank you.
Fun. We decided that we would go ahead at the beginning of the sequence. She opens up the cabinet and a whole bunch of pills fall out with bottles. And we just took a whole bunch of empty prescription bottles, and they weren't. No, some of them weren't empty. There's fun stuff in there, and that's what's used as the shakers throughout the entire series. Is these prescription pills, and we would take pictures.
Have some OxyContin around.
Not me. Nate, you go out of your way to find unique instrumentation and instruments. Can you give us some examples of some various unusual instruments that you've used? I know you have a great ethnomusicology.
I have a human bone trumpet. I've actually had a couple funny first dates introducing that as an instrument.
We get the real story.
It's a femur. It's a human femur from Tibet. And they seem to take some of the monks there when they die, and they turn their leg bones into trumpets and then their skull caps into percussion instruments. It's pretty gruesome, but they're cool. For me as a composer, I get really stale really quick on the keyboard. So when I feel myself going there, I just sort of go online on eBay and start looking around for weird instruments that I can't necessarily play, but at least they get me to think about harmony and melody in a different new way. And so that's why I do that. And I'm also a musician too, so I mean, it just keeps the whole process organic and fresh for me. And we all get into our patterns, that we get locked into in terms of physically how we play something. And when you mix it up a bit, it opens you up as a composer, I think.
I was just in Spain with Nate, and he did an amazing concert of his music from True Blood. You guys, but I didn't recall seeing the trumpet layout, but it was fascinating, and it is great. It's great. He does play all this weird stuff, and he plays a lot of it.
And for True Blood, you play all the instruments for True Blood as well. Yeah.
So he did a great job. So.
Yeah. And I always say that this panel should be 2 hours because we just don't get to anywhere near what we could with this panel. But I did want to mention to the audience that we have a great amount of swag to people that ask questions. So we have signed scores, signed score CDs. We have all sorts of fun stuff that these guys talk about. Wow. So we're going to open it up to the Q&A, and with the lovely lady, and you were the fastest. You got there before anybody else, because you're young.
Wait, this is Tim, Mr. Zuckerman. Do you write the music before or after you see the animation, and which way is easier?
Great question.
I think every Avatar episode is written after the animation, except for the main title. I think some of that was done before. So I can't really say whether it's easier, but comparing like writing to animation versus writing a piece of music that is just a piece of music unto itself. I've gotten very used to writing to picture, and it's kind of nice because you don't have to, you know, the form of the piece of the music is determined by the animation. So it kind of tells me what to write, what comes next, and I don't have to think so hard. It's a bit easier actually to write that way. I have to unfortunately admit to. But yeah, I was right after.
Come on down and get something out of grab bag. That's a great question.
A question for Michael Giacchino. I just want to say all of you are incredibly talented, and of course in the industry, talent doesn't always equal powerful. And my question to you is, on the film The Incredibles, how did you convince the filmmakers to let you do all of that recording that you did that was analog, done in the retro style to get the sound of that movie?
I didn't have to convince them. It was just the process by which I recorded. I recorded everything that way, all Alias, all everything, up into and including Ratatouille, because at this point it's too hard to get the amount of tape and the consistency you need to do it. I can't do it anymore, but it was just my process, and they supported it. They, you know, they just said, go for it. And it does, it is, I love the sound of that long tape. But yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
Come on down.
I just want to say thank you all for coming. I hope I'm bringing up a subject that's not too taboo, but I wanted to ask the panel their feelings on the synergy between licensed music for film and television and your projects and composing. And do you see a synergy between the two when you work on a project? Do you work closely with music supervisors to create like an overall soundscape? I mean, take something like True Blood, where licensed music is really important and the score is very important. Do you collaborate with Gary a lot, or if you could expand on that?
That in itself is a question that yeah. probably lasts about 3 hours. Go ahead.
I was just going to say really quick. Gary. It allows composers, I think, when the songs have such a regional sound like they do in True Blood, it frees the composer up to sort of explore otherwise. But that's just my experience in True Blood. So we do not communicate that much. Gary handles the songs, I handle the score. But because they're so different, it frees us both up.
On Nurse Jackie, there's only a few places where there will be a needle drop. So... it frees us up to really stay true to the score, so we don't have to become something else. The marriage is nice. It can also be very, very difficult when you're doing a really, really popular genre on television or in film where there's more needle drops and more licensing than there is score, and that's when it becomes, it can be very difficult.
Well, also there's a problem sometimes when they don't have the budget to get all the songs that they want, and then they ask the composer to rip it off.
Right.
Something like that, and you have to do that in like 5 minutes when it's like a really produced song. And sometimes that's a problem. Yeah, it's a new way of doing things.
Yeah, there's also an opportunity, like it doesn't have to be a straight master license, but it can also support the storytelling. In Pushing Daisies, we license lots of songs, but I always had to recreate the arrangements to make it the style of the show. It doesn't happen. We didn't license the bangles that turn the flame, because like, they need to be interrupted with her baking a pie. So there's purposes where it can actually tell a story. Morning Has Broken, when Ellen Green sang that when she was mourning, mourning death. There's places where it can actually support the story. It does actually cause a lot of work, but it actually does. When it's on point, the story helps elevate the characters. It's a great, the best of things.
Thanks.
We got time for one more.
Just really quickly, my name is Nisla Kamis. I also just graduated from Berkeley too, so we're. I'm sure this room is full of aspiring composers, so for whoever wants to take it, just advice on kind of toughing it out in, I don't know, like free work too, because I know a lot of people who go for years just doing free work and then they get stale and they look like sliced bread on the floor and they can't do it anymore. So I just wanted to know just your thoughts in general on that.
You
you gotta just find people that you love making things with. You know, that's the big thing. You know, it shouldn't be about anything other than your love of making something. You know, I think we all got into this because we love being creative, we love getting out there and taking nothing and making something. And I think spending your time making things with people who you love being is a really good start.
I've also said this about aspiring composers. It's not enough to be a composer. You have to be a great fan of storytelling. Yeah. You just continue seeing movies and enjoying seeing movies. Enjoy reading books that talk about stories and think about what the sounds would be like. It's not just about having a skill to compose. If that's half the gig, you got to really do it.
It's almost less than half the kid. You really got to have story chops.
Yeah.
Please help me thank this.